Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. Here are some of today's business headlines. New York Times posts gains in advertising and subscription revenue. Disney plans new theme park in Abu Dhabi. Veolia to buy CDPQ's stake in Water Technologies and Solutions for $1.75 billion. Outlook Steakhouse owner guides for softer quarter. CrowdStrike to cut 5% of workforce. Novo Nordisk investors breathe sigh of relief despite guidance hit from copycat drugs. TikTok assures advertisers it's confident in the future. NPR PBS stations raise money, plan cost cuts after Trump order. Hollywood wanted Trump to bring movie making back to the U.S., but not like this. The Wall Street Journal, ProPublica, and Reuters win Pulitzer Prizes. Trump's planned Hollywood tariff rattles studios and streamers. The first article I'll read today is New York Times posts gains in advertising and subscription revenue. The publisher ended the first quarter with more than 11 million digital-only subscriptions, by Jeffrey A. Tackenberg. The New York Times added about 250,000 digital-only subscribers during the first quarter and reported increases in both subscription and advertising revenue compared to the prior year period. Our strategy is working and our business is growing and demonstrating resilience amidst the current economic and geopolitical uncertainty, said Times Chief Executive Meredith Coppett Levin. More than 11.6 million people now subscribe to at least one of the Times digital or print products. Those include news as well as games and cooking offerings, The Athletic and Wirecutter, its consumer product review site. Revenue rose more than 7% to $636 million, while net profit increased to $49.6 million, or 30 cents per share. Analysts polled by FactSet expected the company to earn 34 cents a share on revenue of $635 million. Revenue at The Athletic increased by 28% to nearly $48 million. That included a 18.5% increase in subscription revenues to nearly $33 million. The Athletic made an adjusted operating profit of $2.9 million in the quarter, compared with a loss of $8.7 million in the year-ago quarter. The New York Times said it ended the quarter with slightly more than 11 million digital-only subscribers, which nearly 6 million were bundled in multi-product subscribers. Digital subscription revenue rose more than 14% to $335 million. Total subscription revenues increased 8.2% to $464.3 million. Digital advertising revenue made up 65.6% of total ad revenue for the company in the first quarter, up from nearly 61% in the prior year period. Declines in the entertainment and luxury categories weighed on print ad revenues, the Times said. Total advertising revenues increased more than 4% to $108 million. The Times recorded $4.4 million in pretext litigation costs in the quarter related to its copyright lawsuit against Microsoft and OpenAI, first filed in late 2023. The Times said it expects digital-only subscription revenues to increase between 13% and 16% in the second quarter from the 2024 period. It forecast a high single-digit increase in digital advertising revenue and total ad revenue to be flat or increase by low single digits. Write to Jeffrey A. Trachtenberg, at jeffrey.tractenberg@wsj.com. Disney plans new theme park in Abu Dhabi. The planned new international theme park is part of a broader expansion of its experiences business by Ben Fritz and Isabella Simonetti. Disney is planning a new theme park in Abu Dhabi, an expansion of its lucrative experiences business that will give the entertainment company an anchor in a major new market. The new Disneyland project will be the company's seventh global park. It will be designed in Disney Imagineers and financed and built by Mural, a local company that has built theme parks for other companies on the same island where the new project will be located. We know there's Disney brand affinity in the wide Middle East region, but we've pretty much just scratched the surface, Disney chief executive Bob Iger said in an interview. The company's parks in China and France have helped boost its other businesses such as films, streaming, and consumer products. Disney said Wednesday that its U.S. parks attracted more guests and higher spending from visitors in the March quarter. Though international operating income from experiences declined, operating income for the entire experiences business, which includes theme parks and cruises, rose 9% to $2.49 billion in the quarter. The company announced plans in late 2023 to spend about $60 billion to expand its parks, cruise lines, and resorts over the next decade. It has invested heavily in cruises and late last year unveiled plans for new U.S. rides and attractions, signs of the growing importance of a unit that accounts for a majority of the company-wide operating income. Mural's financing of the new park will allow Disney to invest more in other projects. As we plan our capital allocation, this fits in beautifully, Iger said. Disney hasn't announced a launch date or how big the new Abu Dhabi park will be to start. In return for licensing its intellectual property and its work on design and operations for the park, Disney will receive an unspecified share of revenue the park generates. Iger said it will accretive his company's earnings from opening. The announcement followed a strong quarterly earnings report for Disney that lifted shares about 6% in pre-market trading. Another important business, streaming, notched positive results during the March quarter. The company's entertainment streaming business, which includes the Disney and Hulu services, reported a profit of $336 million for the period, compared with $47 million in the same period a year earlier. Disney and Hulu had 180.7 million subscribers in the end of March, up 2.5 million from the prior quarter. The company added Disney subscribers despite previously forecasting a modest decline. Disney's ESPN is planning to take its flagship network direct to consumer later this year. The company's television networks reported a 2% increase in operating income for the quarter to $769 million from the previous year. Disney Thunderbolts from Marvel Studios topped expectations with its box office debut last week, and the company said it has a strong theatrical slate ahead. Overall, Disney's $23.62 billion in revenue rose 7% from the period a year earlier. The company reported a net income of $3.3 billion compared with the $20 million loss a year earlier. Like rivals, Disney has been facing long-term issues such as declining cable TV usage, as well as near-term threats such as the possibility of a tariff-induced economic slowdown that chills advertising and travel. Disney cautioned that it recognized economic uncertainty would shadow its operating environment for the balance of the fiscal year. Write to Ben Fritz at ben.fritz@wsj.com and Isabella Simonetti at isabella.simonetti at WSJ.com. Veolia to buy CDPQ stake in Water Technologies and Solutions for $1.75 billion. The deal is expected to lead to annual cost synergies of 90 million euros by Adria Cataliud. Veolia said it agreed to buy Casey Depot at placement du Quebec's minority stake in its Water Technologies and Solutions subsidiary for $1.75 billion, taking full ownership. The French utility and resource management company said Wednesday that the acquisition of the investment group's 30% stake will allow it to achieve cost savings and accelerate earnings growth at the business. It now aims to achieve an annual growth rate in earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization of at least 10% for its Water Technologies division over the 2023 to 2027 period, it said. The business generated an EBITDA of 612 million euros, that's $695.8 million, in 2024, with an organic growth rate of 16%. Sales in the first quarter of 2025 were stable on year. The deal, due to be completed by the end of June, is expected to lead to annual cost synergies of 90 million euros by 2027, the company said. This, in turn, should serve as an important new growth driver in achieving its medium-term EBITDA target, RBC Capital Markets analyst said in a note to clients. Whilst additional synergies are positive, Jefferies analyst Yi Shi Ho notes that the transaction is part of Veolia's Green Up plan and not incremental. Market will likely be concerned over balance sheet headroom, he said. JP Morgan analysts find the acquisition to be strategic, but note results for the first quarter were only neutral. The company posted sales for the three-month period that fell to 11.51 billion euros from 11.57 billion euros the prior year period. The figure missed analysts' expectation of 11.62 billion euros according to consensus estimates provided by Visible Alpha. Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, however, rose to 1.70 billion euros from 1.62 billion euros, with a margin expansion of 14.7% from 14.1%, it said. Current earnings before interest and taxes also rose, amounting to 915 million euros, up from 843 million euros, it added. Veolia backed its guidance for the year, targeting organic EBITDA growth at about 5% to 6% and current net income growth of around 9%, it said. Shares traded 2.5% lower at 31.63 euros. Write to Nina Kienle at Nina, K-I-E-N-L-E, at WSJ.com and Adria dot Calatayud, that's Calatayud, at WSJ.com. Outback Steakhouse owner guides for softer quarter. The Outback Steakhouse owner posted an IQ profit of $442.2 million, or 50 cents a share, compared with a loss of $83.9 million, or 96 cents a share a year ago, by Dean Seal. Bloomin' Brands struck its full-year outlook despite choppy consumer trends, though is guiding for a softer second quarter than Wall Street had been targeting. The Outback Steakhouse owner said it expects comparable sales to fall 1.5% to 2.5% in the quarter. Current quarter, and for adjusted earnings to come in at 22 cents to 27 cents a share. Analysts polled by FactSet had been forecasting for comparable sales to fall by less than 1% and for adjusted earnings to hit 37 cents a share. The restaurant operator, which also owns Bonefish Grill and Carrabba's Italian Grill, maintained its full year's guidance. Chief Executive Mike Spanos said the choppy macroeconomic environment is reflected in the current outlook. For the first 3 months of the year, Bloomin posted a profit of $42.2 million, or 50 cents a share, compared with a loss of $83.9 million, or 96 cents a share, in the same quarter a year earlier. The year earlier quarter included a significant loss from the extinguishment of debt that didn't recur this year. Adjusted earnings, which strip out one-time items of 59 cents a share, topped analyst estimates by 2 cents, according to FactSet. Revenue ticked down slightly to $1.05 billion, ahead of projections for $1.03 billion. Comparable sales were down half a percentage point overall, with Outback seeing a 1.3% decline and Bonefish a 4% drop. Carrabba's recorded a 1.4% higher comparable sales, and its smaller Fleming Prime Steakhouse and Wine Bar notched at a 5.1% gain. The net impact of store closures and openings also weighed on the top line. Write to Dean Seal at dean.seal@wsj.com. CrowdStrike to cut 5% of workforce. Cybersecurity company will continuing to hire customer-facing and product engineering roles. By Dean Seal. CrowdStrike said it will cut about 500 jobs, or 5% of its global workforce, as part of a plan to drive efficiencies in the business. The cybersecurity company said Wednesday that it intends to cut positions in some areas of the business while continuing to hire customer-facing and product engineering roles. These changes position us to move faster, operate more efficiently, and continue our cybersecurity leadership, Chief Executive George Kurtz said in a letter to employees. CrowdStrike said it will start meeting with affected employees over the next day, and that the company offices will be closed on Wednesday and Thursday. Staff have been asked to work from home on those days, and everyone already in the office has been instructed to head home for the day. The company expects to incur $36 million to $56 million in charges tied to severance payments, employee benefits, and non-cash charges for stock-based compensation. About $7 million of that will be recognized in the recently completed fiscal first quarter, with the rest incurred in the current quarter. The cuts should be substantially completed by the end of the current quarter. The cuts come after CrowdStrike provided full-year earnings guidance in March that fell short of analyst forecasts. The Austin-based company also reported swinging to a loss in the fourth quarter of fiscal 2025, which ended January 31st. CrowdStrike reaffirmed its full-year outlook on Wednesday and said it would report fiscal first-quarter results on June 3rd that are expected to be in line with or above its guidance from March. Shares slid 2.2% to $433.50 in pre-market trading. Write to Dean Seal at dean.seal@wsj.com. Why San Francisco hates the idea of turning Alcatraz back into a prison. Visitors to the notorious prison contemplated Trump's idea from inside cramped windowless cells. By Jim Carlton and Sarah Randazzo. San Francisco, to some in this city, turning Alcatraz back into a prison would be a crime. The Rock closed 62 years ago, and San Francisco has channeled the public's macabre fascination with life inside the notorious prison to turn it into one of the city's top tourist attractions. Visitors can wander through the gardens of Alcatraz, peruse the big lockup exhibit, or take a night tour where one can enjoy the beauty of a sunset silhouetting the Golden Gate Bridge, as well as experience a cell door demonstration. Over the years, Boy Scouts have clamored to hold overnight campouts in the infamous isolation cells of D Block. Athletes compete in prison-themed events, including a canoe race circling the island and the Escape from Alcatraz triathlon. Calling the prison a symbol of law and order, Trump on Sunday said, he is directing the Bureau of Prisons and other federal agencies to rebuild Alcatraz to house America's most ruthless and violent offenders. San Francisco boosters aren't keen on the idea, and visitors aren't so sure either. On Monday, National Park Manager Matthew Connolly welcomed a crowd of more than 100 tourists and said he'd take questions, just not all. When the subject of Trump's proposal came up, he looked concerned and directed a reporter to call public affairs. Those in the packed tour had plenty of thoughts after trudging from a ferry boat up a steep quarter-mile walkway to the imposing fortress. Before entering the main gate, an Australian visitor jokingly suggested Trump lock himself into the new prison there. He should lead by example, the man said with a laugh. He and his wife declined to give their names. No thanks, mate. We want to get home. Taking selfies with his wife in one of the windowless cells in a prison corridor called Broadway, John LaPere, a 62-year-old tourist from the Netherlands, was supportive of Trump's plan. I think the idea itself is to put people on a certain island where they have no comfort, especially for those high delinquents. That's a good idea, LaPere said. But he was wary of whether such a historic site could again be made into a modern prison complex. Sitting in what had been the Chow Hall, Londoners Chris Manilowski and Noemi Alexandra said that instead of doubling down on a prison with such stark conditions, Trump should take a page from Norway, which treats prisoners well and has low recidivism rates. I think the times would have changed, and for prisoners to spend a week without showering in those dark cells, it's too much, Manilowski, 28 years old, said. Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco agreed, calling the president's idea unhinged and terrifying. Trump wants to turn Alcatraz into a domestic gulag in the middle of San Francisco Bay, Wiener wrote on social media. Trump said reopening Alcatraz ties to his campaign promise to lower violent crime. His pitch harks back to the prison's 1930 origins, when it opened to deal with the most incorrigible inmates in federal prisons. According to a government history, it operated as maximum security facility for nearly three decades, closing in 1963 because of millions of dollars it needed repairs and the expense of hauling all supplies, including fresh water, to the facility by boat. Alcatraz was tiny by the standards of most federal facilities, never housing more than around 275 prisoners. Its shadow is huge. The prison has graced the silver screen in such films as Michael Bay's 1996 action thriller, The Rock, and 1979's Escape from Alcatraz, starring Clint Eastwood. It housed famous criminals including mobster Al Capone and George Machine Gun Kelly. At times, Alcatraz was almost as famous for those who tried to escape as it was for those who were inside. Contrary to myth, cold temperatures and strong currents, not sharks, were the biggest obstacles to making the mile-plus to shore. Trained swimmers as young as age 9 have successfully made the journey that so many prisoners failed. In one unsuccessful escape in 1941, a prisoner who gave up after hitting the bay's cold water later tried to escape again from a San Francisco federal courtroom. Another man attempted to leave by stealing an army uniform and calmly walking aboard an army launch. He was promptly returned to Alcatraz when the boat landed at nearby Angel Island. Today, more than 1 million visitors each year travel to the island, according to the National Park Service. In peak season, tourists book tickets weeks in advance. Not everyone in San Francisco has understood why a sinister prison is such a draw. It's heinous, declared one writer on Brooke Ass Stewart, a local alternative website, noting the irony of a progressive city touting a museum of human suffering. I don't think moms from Minnesota should be allowed to take selfies in rooms where men pushed past the point of no return hung themselves. For those looking to bring a dose of reality back home from the prison tour, visitors can buy rectangular magnets reminding them of Alcatraz's central tenets, like Regulation Number 5. You are entitled to food, clothing, shelter, and medical attention. Anything else you get is a privilege. Parents seeking some tough love discipline can slap Regulation 23 on the fridge. If you make groundless complaints for the purpose of stirring up trouble, you will be subject to disciplinary action. For $13.95, tourists can also take home a replica tin inmate cup, which had the advantage back in the day of not being able to be broken into shards that could become a weapon. Carson Brock, a 24-year-old from Cincinnati who voted for Trump, said the prison's gift shop that he favors preserving Alcatraz's history over reopening. But if that's what he wants to do, then I guess he could so be it, he said. One Alberta resident touring the island was reticent to share her views, but concluded, "We're Canadian. We don't really care." Visitor Mike Neville, another Trump supporter, said he thinks turning Alcatraz back into a prison would be cost prohibitive. The 61-year-old visiting from Colorado Springs, Colorado, has a better plan. "I always liked the idea of turning it into a casino." Write to Jim Carlton at jim.carlton@wsj.com and Sarah Randazzo at sarah.randazzo, that's R-A-N-D-A-Z-Z-O, at wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. I don't know where you are. The race to fix air traffic control. Recent tech failures and near misses expose problems with antiquated system. Trump administration pledges overhaul. By Andrew Tangel. At about 1:30 in the afternoon on April 28th, air traffic controllers overseeing the busy airspace around Newark Liberty International Airport suddenly faced a frightening scenario. The chatter from pilots they were communicating with went silent. Radar screens filled with dots showing aircraft's positions went dark. Backup systems failed. Planes bound for the area went into holding patterns. About 90 seconds later, the traffic control system started blinking back to life, but problems lingered with the radar, and controllers worried the radios would go out again. "We don't have a radar, so I don't know where you are," a controller told United Airlines Flight 674 arriving from Charleston, South Carolina, instructing its crew to watch out for other planes without controllers' help. Another controller offered a warning to a private plane. "I want to at least get you towards something and clear of all the other aircraft in case we lose the frequency again." There were no crashes, but scores of flights coming and going were delayed for hours, and dozens scheduled to arrive in Newark were diverted to other airports. The controllers who oversee Newark airspace from the Federal Aviation Administration's thinly staffed facility in Philadelphia were rattled. Four left the facility that day and sought short-term trauma-related leave, according to people familiar with the situation. Days later, the controller's radio briefly went out again, further scrambling operations in Newark and air travel elsewhere. America's air traffic control system has been troubled for years. The accumulation of years of anemic funding, archaic technology, and staffing problems. A wake-up call sounded on January 29th with a mid-air collision near the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport that killed 67 people. President Trump and Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy have pledged to overhaul the system. If we don't take aggressive action, you're going to see tech problems in other places, Duffy said in an interview after visiting the Philadelphia facility on Friday. I don't want to see that happen. The Government Accountability Office said last year that about three-quarters of the FAA's 138 air traffic systems were either obsolete or potentially too difficult to reliably maintain. Duffy said he's preparing to unveil a plan this week to upgrade the FAA's network of facilities, radars, and other technology, which industry and government officials believe could cost $20 billion to $40 billion. Since the January 29 crash, the FAA has been examining the design of routes around busy airports. There was a slim margin of error for error between helicopter and airplane routes at Reagan National. In other incidents, missteps by controllers or pilots have put aircraft on collision courses. Key technology has also been unreliable. In early 2023, the malfunctioning of a system that distributes pilot safety notices prompted the first nationwide ground stop since September 11, 2001. Terrorist attacks. FAA officials said they would slow down air travel to maintain safety. After last week's outages, the agency cut traffic flows into Newark. If there's some issues with equipment, we're going to slow things down, or we're going to shut things down, Duffy said, because though I want an incredibly efficient airspace, when I'm confronted with safety, safety is always paramount. Industry and government officials have studied data and suggested fixes to address close calls, but the ingredients for a catastrophe involving air traffic control remained. Investigators looking into the January collision between an Army helicopter and an American Airlines regional jet preparing to land in Washington Reagan are examining why one controller was juggling both helicopter and airplane traffic. Despite an FAA policy to have standalone controller focusing on choppers at that time of day, the FAA has since closed the route used by the helicopter to most traffic. Investigators are also examining the roles of pilots and other factors in the incident. Tensions have remained high at Reagan National's control tower. In late March, a controller running the Reagan Tower punched another controller after he refused to monitor helicopter traffic, according to people briefed on the exchange. Airport police issued a misdemeanor summons for assault and battery to a 39-year-old controller. Local authorities declined to comment on the case. The nation's aviation system handles some 45,000 commercial, private, and military flights a day. Air traffic control facilities oversee civilian airspace, dividing the skies by geography and altitude. Tracking aircraft on radar scopes, controllers tell pilots where to turn, when to descend or climb, and how fast to fly. The FAA has some 10,700 fully certified controllers, leaving it about 3,000 short of its target. Controllers have complained of fatigue from often having to work 10-hour days, 6 days a week as a result. Threatening to make the shortage worse, about 500 controllers are eligible to retire and begin receiving federal pensions. The FAA, in accordance with federal law, has a mandatory retirement age for controllers of 56. Last week, Duffy announced 20% bonuses for retirement-eligible controllers each year they stay on the job. Controllers have been exempt from Trump's cuts to the federal workforce. During a February visit by Duffy to the FAA's Air Traffic Academy in Oklahoma City, one student told him, "It's a lot of work. It's a lot of stress. You've got to be ready for that commitment. It's like a full 2-year degree in 4 months." Duffy has announced a 30% pay boost to nearly $23 an hour for students at the academy and other changes aimed at attracting controller candidates. Entry-level pay for graduates is around $47,000, according to the FAA, although it's higher in many metropolitan areas. Median pay for air traffic controllers is around $145,000 a year, Bureau of Labor Statistics data show. The FAA said recruiting efforts are showing signs of paying off. The agency has struggled for years to shore up staffing at one important New York facility. Last year, the agency shifted oversight of airspace around Newark's airport to Philadelphia from Long Island, New York. It hoped that the move would help attract and retain more controllers. For years, that facility had been a flashpoint of tension over the training of new controllers, part of a nationwide history of labor management skirmishes over controller compensation, staffing levels, and working conditions. The setup in Philadelphia wasn't a full-fledged air traffic control operation. Its radar depended on a relay from the primary facility more than 100 miles away on Long Island. The FAA said Monday it was working to make telecommunications equipment in the New York area more reliable and resilient, and expects to complete a permanent fix this year. Controllers have faced a series of tech problems that have snarled air traffic and risked safety. Staffing levels haven't improved significantly, and absences due to trauma leave have only added to the workload. The FAA said it has several trainees who will be able to supplement staffing. On November 6th, a controller was guiding a FedEx cargo plane to land at Newark's airport when the main and backup air traffic control radios went dead. Cut off from controllers, the Boeing 767 blew past Newark and flew over the Hudson River and Manhattan and into traffic lanes for planes flying into and out of LaGuardia Airport in Queens. FedEx said its crew complied with controller instructions and landed safely. Officials scrambled to figure out how the air traffic communication outage was playing out across the Northeast. According to audio of recorded phone calls released by the FAA in response to a public records request by the Wall Street Journal, all the headlines lit up and were just like, "Going nuts, and then we lost frequencies. Nobody could talk to anybody," one official told his counterpart in one call that evening. "We sterilized the airspace. We stopped everything." Disaster was averted, but the outage affected several of FAA facilities in the Northeast. The FAA traced the failure to a multiplexer box at a New York facility, according to records obtained by the Journal. The component had reached the end of its life cycle and was due to be replaced a couple of hours before the failure, according to a November 8th email from an FAA manager. Already thin staffing at the Philadelphia facility overseeing Newark was further depleted when some of its controllers opted to take so-called trauma leave from their jobs. "Our staffing is in dire straits. It's awful. Not safe or efficient in any way," one controller who handles Newark air traffic said in an interview. "It's a crisis, and the public doesn't know about it. It's happening here at Newark, and nobody wants to pay attention until lives are lost." He described the April 28th radar and radio outage as the most stressful situation of his career. "The chaos at Newark that day stretched across the country. A United flight from San Francisco was forced to divert to Bradley Airport in Hartford, Connecticut, after circling over western Pennsylvania for nearly an hour. The airline said it diverted 37 flights and canceled about 100 more. At Newark, flights that day were delayed in many cases by 4 hours or more." Duffy said FAA officials are working with telecommunications companies to diagnose and fix what caused the outage. "We're putting some Band-Aids on some really old systems," he said, calling for a complete program to overhaul it to make it brand new. The FAA uses most of its technology and equipment funding to sustain equipment that in some cases dates to the 1950s. A senior agency official said, many facilities are connected by copper wire landlines, which are at risk of failing or being shut down before the FAA can replace them with fiber optic connections. Each week, the system suffers about 700 communication outages, according to the senior FAA official. Some operating practices are dated. In many air traffic facilities, controllers rely on paper printouts called flight strips for help in tracking flights. They pass the strips to one another, conveying new information like route changes verbally and by writing it down. An electronic system now exists, but cost increases and delays have slowed a broader rollout. These things keep us from what we should be doing, seeing, looking, making decisions, and constantly giving all of our attention to the aircraft, said Nick Daniels, president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Elon Musk dispatched engineers from his rocket company, SpaceX, to study and suggest fixes to the FAA's technology. Transportation Department officials say Musk's Starlink satellite internet network could be part of a broader solution, such as potential backup for communications between facilities. Some of what SpaceX team told FAA officials, the agency already knew. They said, oh, you need to move off of your telecommunications network ASAP, recall the senior FAA official. Last September, the Biden administration asked Congress for $8 billion in additional funding over 5 years to make improvements, including replacing air traffic control facilities and modernizing radar systems. Lawmakers didn't act on the request, the latest chapter in a years-long battle between aviation officials and politicians over how to improve air safety. A House spending bill this year has allocated $12.5 billion for upgrades. Duffy said Trump's backing will help his overhaul succeed where others have failed, and that he doesn't anticipate much pushback from Congress. They're going to have to work on how they find the resources to do this project, he said, but I have faith that they'll figure it out. Last Thursday, near Reagan Airport, an Army helicopter traveling to the Pentagon came within a half mile horizontally and a few hundred feet vertically of a Delta Airlines regional jet, according to a preliminary internal FAA document and a person familiar with the matter. The regional airline operating the flight said it would assist with the probe into the event. The Army has paused flights around the Pentagon pending a review of the incident, an Army official said. On Monday, after an apparent close call involving two small planes near Newark, the previous day, a controller filed an internal safety report, which was reviewed by the journal. The situation has been and continues to be unsafe, and it is only a matter of time until a lot of people die, the controller wrote. The equipment is unsafe to use, unusable, both communications and radar. The amount of stress we are under is insurmountable. The FAA said it is investigating the Sunday event and that it takes all safety reports seriously and takes necessary action. Write to Andrew Tangle at andrew.tangle@wsj.com. Hegseth used multiple signal chats for official Pentagon business. In at least one message, he asked aides to tell foreign countries about military operation by Alexander Ward and Nancy Youssef. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth used signal more extensively for official Pentagon business than previously disclosed, engaging in at least a dozen separate chats, people familiar with his management practices said. In one case, he told aides on the encrypted app to inform foreign governments about an unfolding military operation, the people said. He also used the non-governmental message service to discuss media appearances, foreign travel, his schedule, and other unclassified but sensitive information. The former Fox News host set up many of his chats himself, sending texts from an unsecured line in his Pentagon office and from his personal phone, the two said. Some of Hegseth's messages were posted by his military aide, Marine Colonel Ricky Buria, who was given access to the secretary's personal phone. It was Buria who posted information in March about an imminent U.S. attack on Houthi militants in Yemen into a Signal chat group that included the secretary's wife, brother, and private lawyer, the people said. Hegseth's frequent use of the app in his daily duties and Buria's role in posting information on his behalf haven't been previously reported. The Pentagon and Buria didn't respond to requests for comment. Acting Pentagon Inspector General Stephen Stebbins said last month that he was investigating Hegseth's use of Signal after the disclosure by The Atlantic magazine that the secretary had posted information about the Yemen strikes in a chat involving senior administration officials. Similar information posted in the separate chat that included Hegseth's family members is also part of the Inspector General inquiry. Among the messages posted in some of the other chats by Hegseth were his thoughts on personal matters, Pentagon programs facing cuts, and details of administration national security debates. The texts authorizing aides to tell allies about military operations are among the most sensitive messages he sent. Instead of using the Pentagon's vast communications network, Hegseth preferred Signal to run the Defense Department's day-to-day operations, the people said. Among those he added to chats were members of his security detail, staffers in his personal office, and that of the deputy secretary, as well as public affairs aides. To read the messages, aides routinely had to step away from their desks to find a location in the Pentagon that received phone service, which is spotty in the building. Previous administrations have used the non-governmental messaging apps, but using Signal to share closely guarded information could put sensitive information at the risk of landing in the wrong hands, experts say. The use of personal phones and commercial apps introduces unnecessary risk. Signal is considered an unclassified by the government for a reason, said Mark Polymorphoulos, a former senior U.S. intelligence officer. It's clear that U.S. government systems are having a hard time keeping up with the required pace of business. In some cases, Hegseth's messages disappeared without being properly recorded, the people familiar with his management practices said, potentially a violation of laws requiring official records to be preserved. A 2023 Pentagon directive restricts the use of some non-governmental apps, including Signal, for official business, saying such messaging services shouldn't be used for sensitive but unclassified information. DoD personnel won't use non-DoD accounts or personal email accounts, messaging systems, or rather non-public DoD information systems, except approved or authorized government contractor systems to conduct official business. The memo from the Pentagon Chief Information Officer said, it couldn't be determined whether Signal has been approved for use by Pentagon officials since the memo was issued. This memo isn't definitive to determine the legality of Secretary Hegseth's use of Signal on a personal device to transmit non-public, unclassified DoD information, said Aram Gavur, the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a National Security Law Professor at George Washington University Law School. President Trump said last week that he planned to shift National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who lost favor with the White House in part because of his role in the Signal controversy, out of his post. Waltz, who inadvertently added the editor of The Atlantic to a Signal group about U.S. strikes in Yemen, will be nominated to be ambassador to the United Nations and is likely to face questions during his confirmation hearing about his and Hegseth's use of the encrypted app. Hegseth shared some of the most sensitive information on the Signal chat group that included other senior officials, including specific times that the F-18's MQ-9 Reaper drones and Tomahawk cruise missiles would be used in the March 15th attack, according to a transcript released by The Atlantic. The group was established by Waltz. In an interview Sunday with NBC's Meet the Press, Trump said that Hegseth's job was totally safe and that he wasn't looking for a new defense chief. "Pete's going to be great," Trump said. "He's doing a great job." Write to Alexander Ward at alex.ward@wsj.com and Nancy A. Youssef at nancy.youssef@wsj.com. And now for some opinion articles. The case for fixing food stamps. Its work requirement is evaded, and states don't share in its costs. By the editorial board. House Republicans are trying to sort out their policy differences on their budget bill, and the press is looking for fissures that could sink the bill. But there's no reason to shun the harder issues, and one of them is the need to fix the dysfunctional federal food assistance program. The House Agriculture Committee is shooting to save $230 billion over 10 years, and a big account is the roughly $100 billion a year Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. Despite what you read elsewhere, Republicans aren't indifferent to whether children and the poor have enough to eat. But more than 41 million Americans are on food stamps, and the program long ago ceased to be temporary help for those who fall on hard times. Enrollment doesn't shrink any longer in a strong economy as it should, and the roles include millions of adults who can work. The program is contributing to one of America's most pressing social ailments, prime age men attenuated from work and its attendant disciplines and contributions to society. The program on paper requires that able-bodied adults without dependents work part-time or lose benefits after 3 months. Yet the Economic Policy Innovation Center, EPIC, a think tank, estimates that a mere 16% of these adults work 20 hours a week or more. Government data suggests that only 28% of such adults have earned income. That's in part because states exploit waivers from the federal government to dilute the work requirement. States rely on old unemployment data and gerrymander regions to paint locales as scenes from the Great Depression. By one estimate, nearly 40% of these able-bodied adults without dependents live in areas where the work requirement is waived. Congress can crack down on the waiver offenses and make work a centerpiece of the program in the tradition of the GOP's 1990s welfare reform. The 20-hour work requirement also ought to apply to those who have children old enough to attend school. Parents can fulfill the requirement during school hours, and job training or volunteering at a church checks the box. Anyone who thinks this is cruel should read the compelling academic evidence that growing up around adults who work is crucial for a child's shot at upward mobility. Last year's paper from economist Raj Chetty and colleagues. But the food stamp dysfunction runs deeper. States manage the program, but the feds pick up 100% of the benefits tab, which means states have an incentive to draw down more federal dollars. No wonder the program's improper payment figure is north of 10%, according to Agricultural Department data. Multiple policy analysts have proposals giving states a stake in the program, and President Trump's 2018 budget included a version of the idea. Congress can ask states to pick up 10% of the benefits tab the first year, then 15%, and perhaps eventually 25%. EPIC, the think tank, estimates the feds could save $250 billion over 10 years by phasing in a state share of 50%. Governors of both parties won't like a policy change that asks more of them, but states showed in the 1990s, after the federal welfare reform, that they could manage caseloads and help people find their footing back into the private economy. SNAP could use further reform because it discourages additional hours of work as recipients earn more income and lose benefits. But the White House is desperate to avoid anything that can be attacked as a benefit cut, and moderate lawmakers are anxious even about a state cost share. Democrats will attack Republicans as heartless if the GOP even touches the food program. So there's nothing to gain from preemptive surrender. America's food safety net should be fiscally sane and offer incentives so recipients won't need it forever. But Republicans can't defend these basic principles of self-government. They have bigger problems than passing a tax and spending bill. Want to raise birth rates? Immigration is the key. In the U.S., Hispanics tend to have more children, but baby bonuses have proved ineffective everywhere. By Jason L. Riley. It isn't always easy to tell whether President Trump is serious or pulling our leg, and maybe that's the way he likes it. Reopening Alcatraz? Annexing Canada? A tariff on foreign films? Watching a movie made abroad is a threat to our national security, but using TikTok, a social media platform owned by a company based in China, is nothing to worry about. When the president was asked last month if the government should provide incentives for women to have more children, he responded, "Sounds like a good idea to me." Mr. Trump might be serious about this one. Members of his inner circle, including Elon Musk and Vice President J.D. Vance, have been vocal proponents of larger families. The administration reportedly has been fielding pronatal proposals from conservative advocacy groups, one of which would provide a $5,000 baby bonus to new mothers. The concern about low fertility rates in the U.S. is warranted. A fertility rate of 2.1 children per woman is necessary to sustain replacement of the population. Last year, the U.S. birth rate was about 1.6. That was slightly above the record low set in 2023, but still below replacement level, which the U.S. hasn't seen since the mid-2000s. This matters in part because the age and growth rate of a country's population helps determine its economic prosperity. A growing populace can attract capital investment as the market for goods and services expands. Significant innovations and discoveries more often come from people in their 30s and 40s. An aging population could harm our global competitiveness, and without enough young workers to replace retirees, health and pension costs can become debilitating. Europe and Asia have already traveled much further down this demographic road. Japan's population peaked in 2009. In 1975, it had 8 workers for every retiree. By 2005, the ratio had declined to 3.3 workers per retiree. In 2011, for the first time, people in Japan bought more adult diapers than they did diapers for babies, wrote Jonathan Last in his book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.